Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's still physically and emotionally broken from the local election campaign. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and this show is a little bit like in Frasier, when Frasier Crane would be indisposed, and so Roz would put on the best of Frasier. I'm at a wedding in Plymouth this weekend. Congratulations, Phil and Jackie, by the way. And Steve and I did try and meet up on Wednesday in order to try and record an episode for this week. Sadly, just like the House of Lords has done with the EU withdrawal bill, events got in the way that scuppered that particular plan. What we're going to do instead is play you a few short clips from our favourite episodes of last year. There's four of them in all. The first one is the introduction that Steve and I recorded the day after the general election, when that result happened. The second one comes from the first week of that general election campaign, shortly after Boris Johnson had written an article calling Jeremy Corbyn a mugwump. The third one is when we discussed the many iterations of Vince Cable during our silly season in August last year. And the final one is our analysis of Theresa May's Florence speech. Stick around and we hope you enjoy them. Steve, have you deleted everything we've ever said about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership?
Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty sure I've gotten rid of it, and I've burnt the hard drives as well.
Right, everything we said about how rubbish the campaign was?
Yep, it's all gone.
Every time we said that we should fire Seamus Milne out of a cannon?
Yep.
It's all there.
It's all gone. It's all been deleted. It's all been set fire. No one will ever know we ever doubted them.
Fantastic. Right, let's go with this. So, welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that never doubted Jeremy Corbyn's electoral strategy.
Never. Not once.
Not once. What is a dead cat and why is it important?
Dead cats. They are coming up quite a bit in terms of elections because Linton Crosby is running the Conservative campaign. Linton Crosby has a habit of what he calls throwing a dead cat on the table.
Is this a literal dead cat or a metaphorical?
It is a metaphorical dead cat. Not to be confused with Schrodinger's cat, because the dead cat is almost always noticeable and you know exactly what it is.
It's dead.
It's definitely dead, and it's almost certainly attention-grabbing. It's basically an announcement of policy or a statement which is designed to basically hijack the media narrative and put it onto your terms. There have been a couple of examples of this so far during this election.
Before we go on, what's the difference between Linton Crosby's dead cat and Trump doing...
anything.
Basically anything, yeah.
I mean, in a lot of ways, Trump's statements are dead cat. Dead cats being thrown on the table as well. The difference tends to be that Linton Crosby's dead cats tend to be a lot more manipulative and cynical. They are not necessarily things that the party in particular believes, but they are things that will grab the attention and will garner support. There's often a dog whistle involved in there as well.
The dead cat has a dog whistle?
The dead cat definitely has a dog whistle.
Okay, whereas Trump's dead cats, yeah, they're basically just the mad meanderings of an old confused man who just kind of vomits out dead cats from every orifice.
This sounds about right, yes.
I hope you're not eating, listeners, because that's a horrible mental image to keep with you. Okay, so dead cats in this election so far.
So the first one that turned up was Boris Johnson standing up, giving a speech and calling Corbyn a mugwump.
It was an article in The Sun, wasn't it?
Yes.
I think the dead cat was hiding in his hair.
Quite possibly. But essentially, when you look at what a mugwump is, when you look at it all, it's completely meaningless. But it dominated the media. In a way which made sure everything was about Corbyn, which is obviously a massive part of the Conservative Party's general election strategy.
Is it, Steve? I had not noticed that.
I know.
Is the role of the Prime Minister going to be a major factor in their election, do you think?
Yeah, I think it might be. I think it might be. By making a ridiculous comment and calling him a ridiculous name, Boris made sure that everybody was talking about it. because it's Boris, and it's the sort of thing that Boris does. So what it effectively meant was that people were talking about it, which meant people were talking about Jeremy Corbyn's character, which meant people were being reminded on their dinner tables when they were talking with their friends around down the pub about what's a mugwump. They were going, well, Jeremy Corbyn is a mugwump, or at least Boris says he's a mugwump. And then automatically there's an assumption that maybe it's a negative, and therefore it's building up that notion that... That Jeremy Corbyn is ineffectual, that Jeremy Corbyn isn't someone you want leading the part, leading the government.
And it's quite hard to counter, isn't it? Because you can't say, well, Jeremy Corbyn isn't a mugwump, he's more like a fopdoodle. I mean, you could do the Tom Watson approach, who I think...
Did call him a blonde-haired fopdoodle.
Yeah. Oh, yes, was it a cheese-haired fopdoodle?
Something like that. It was, yeah. And again, you can kind of see why Watson went down that approach, but it's not effective as a countering
it's
mechanism.
It's not very statesmanlike. I mean, a foreign secretary obviously isn't statesmanlike, but it's just not.
But yeah, the second and probably the biggest dead cat that's been thrown into the election so far.
A dead tiger, maybe, or a leopard.
I'm going Sabretooth.
Sabretooth tiger.
Yeah. Was Theresa May's speech outside Downing Street, where she accused the EU of interfering in the British election.
Is that like how they interfered in the EU referendum when people were signing their ballots with pens so that the EU couldn't rub them out?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing, yeah.
That's very cack-handed electoral fraud.
Yeah. Theresa May had dinner with Jean-Claude Juncker, EU Commission president, one of Europe's many presidents. The details of that meeting were leaked to a FAS, which I cannot recall what it stands for, but it's a German print-only... newspaper.
Something associated with Deutschland or something.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yeah.
But essentially, it's about as old school tech as you can get. It literally doesn't have any online presence at all. But it just so happens that Jeremy Cliff, who I believe works for The Economist, happened across this article because Jeremy Cliff happens to speak German, I assume. There are a number of things to kind of focus on here. One is that when this article first broke in the UK, Theresa May and the government dismissed it as just idle gossip.
Or basically
tittle tattle, which is essentially your way of saying you've got us banged to rights. This is pretty accurate.
Yeah, it was stuff like Theresa May apparently says to him, "We're going to make a success of Brexit." A succession of
inane statements, repeating
her electioneering talk, basically avoiding the question. And at the end of it, Juncker comes out and says, "I'm 10 times more sceptical about Brexit now than I was before."
Yeah. The government dismisses it as just gossip.
Mm.
Then leaves it 4 days and then comes out and announces that the EU is trying to interfere with the election. Let's break this down. If the government actually thought it was interference, they wouldn't have dismissed it as idle gossip to begin with. So immediately we can play off that notion. The government does not believe what they're saying here.
I didn't know Theresa May played games with politics, did
you? I know. When you look at the timing of the announcement, that came out the day before the local elections... If you needed something to try and rally the Brexiteer base, accusing the EU of trying to interfere in a general election would be a very good way of doing it.
So this is a dead saber-toothed tiger with a dog whistle. Does that make it a mammoth whistle?
Let's say no.
Okay.
What equally is completely nonsensical is the idea that the EU would choose to influence the election in the UK by leaking a report of a dinner to a German paper, which is only printed in German and doesn't have any online presence. Like, Britain as a whole is not multilingual. It is only by sheer luck that Jeremy Cliff happened across this, and it is only by sheer luck that it therefore made the news. So the notion that this is a direct attempt to try and influence the election is clearly a load of cobblers. But that has not stopped the government from coming out and making this statement. Why? Because it puts the news media back on their agenda. It's such a ludicrous statement that it gets people talking. It riles up the Brexiteer base enough to actually get them going, yes, no, this is obviously true. They're clearly trying to influence things. And at the same time, it annoys people who are opposed to Brexit to the point where they mock it and they end up repeating the line, which is exactly something everybody keeps on doing, is repeating the Conservatives' lines and mocking them.
And we're not going to do it on this podcast, Liz,
exactly,
because we are
strategic and sound.
That's the one, yes.
A statement on the EU interfering in the British election is a ginormous example of a dead cat being thrown into the middle of the ring to make people go, look at what we want you to talk about. We want you to focus on the EU because the local elections are tomorrow. We want you to focus on the EU because that's what's going to ensure that a load of the people who voted Brexit even though they were Labour supporters, are going to continue to vote Tory.
This grandstanding as well, it plays into what British Prime Ministers have done over the EU for the best part of two or three decades, which is try and grandstand for the tabloids at home and then try and actually then behind the scenes put forward some sort of half-decent deal with the EU. Right, that's enough on the Happy Pixie. Let's go on to the next cab off the block, Vince Cable, who I'm guessing is not to be confused with the Vince Cable, who in 2007 said he wasn't going to stand for Lib Dem leader because he was too old.
Yeah, no, so clearly a completely different Vince Cable, because this Vince Cable started parroting on about the cult of youth before he'd even won the leadership election, such as it was.
And he's not the other Vince Cable that privatised Royal Mail as well, is he?
That's a completely different Vince Cable.
Is Vince Cable just a traveller through time?
Is Vince Cable about to be replaced by Jodie Whittaker?
to be fair,
probably wouldn't hurt the Lib Dems' polling ratings.
No. One can be glib about 2007, and if you've listened to us in any way, shape or form, listeners, you'll know
we're glib.
Glib is kind of our default setting. But I suppose the leadership election of 2007 was a very different point.
Yes.
Because Min Campbell was 408 years old and looking it.
Yeah.
In 2007, every party was looking for their Tony Blair clone.
Yeah.
And the Lib Dems went, oh, look, Nick Clegg, you are our Tony Blair clone. Although there's the interesting parallel universe in which... Because Nick Clegg only beat Chris Hume by 500 votes.
And there was an entire bag of votes which came in late, which if they turned up on time, would have meant that Chris Hume won.
Mm. And if Chris Hume was deputy leader, while the perjury stuff was going on, that's an interesting what if, parking that. So, it's a very different time. Is Vince Cable the man of the moment?
No.
Why?
I've never necessarily been that impressed with Vince Cable as a politician. A lot of his reputation is based around, he called the economic crash right. Well, yes, he did, but then again, he's called it multiple times.
Is this the Vince Cable's predicted 9 of the last 1 recessions?
Exactly. Mm. That is a well-known phrase, actually, within political circles, because there's an element of truth to it. I mean, Vince is a very bright and capable politician, but I just struggle to see how, even if he had a completely clean slate, how he would be able to reinvigorate the Liberal Democrats as a campaigning and a political force. That's made even more difficult by the fact that he is so attached to the coalition, by the fact that it wasn't just he was a Liberal Democrat and, you know, the Lib Dems treble tuition fees. It's the fact that he's the guy who masterminded that policy. It's his policy.
We're using masterminded in the loosest possible sense.
Yeah. But you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
He was in charge. He was the business secretary whilst that was happening, and he was responsible for it. It was his policy. In a lot of ways, the tuition fee debacle was slightly overblown in terms of its impact on polling and things like that. Most of the drop-off in the Dem support occurred basically the minute they went into coalition with the Tories. But it's symbolic of everything that went wrong with the coalition. And Vince, as the architect of that policy, becomes symbolic as the problems with that coalition, which reminds everybody of why they don't like the Lib Dems anymore.
Well, quite. I mean, Vince Cable spent most of the years in the coalition looking like a man who had left his wife for her sister and was constantly having to justify it in public. So while you got the impression he was... Because he was a member of the SDP, I think, wasn't he?
Yes.
You got the impression he was never really down with the austerity line that Clegg and Danny Alexander pushed quite harshly. He was still a major figure in government while that was going on. It's impossible for him to distance himself. Probably why he lost his seat in Twickenham 2 years ago.
And this is before you even start actually looking into Vince Cable further back. Vince Cable, former head economist for Shell. That's going to be a position where there will be some kind of skeleton somewhere which people, regardless of whether it's necessarily overly true, people can beat him with.
Ironically, because crustaceans live in shells, they don't really have skeletons.
And the other thing is Vince has done a very sterling job during the coalition years of presenting himself as being on the left wing of the Liberal Democrats, as you just kind of said there. Oh yeah, it's the Social Democrat rather than that kind of Orange Book free market wing. Vince Cable wrote a chapter of the Orange Book. Vince Cable is the man who said we should scrap the Department for Business.
Are there four Vince Cables?
There's more, so many Vince Cables. And that's kind of Vince Cable's problem, is that Vince Cable will, in a way it's sort of similar to Tim Farron, will present whichever face of Vince Cable he deems to be most appropriate. Two-faced isn't the right word.
No, we've already established there's four of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Four-faced?
There's so many different versions of Vince Cable that it makes it very difficult to latch on to one as a kind of a dominant narrative, which in some ways in politics can be very beneficial. But when you're already marred and you've got a very long political history like Vince Cable does, it also means there's a hell of a lot of things you can be attacked on. And I think that's really where the issue comes. It's going to be very easy for people to just dismiss Vince Cable because of that political history and the things he's done. There'll be something in it for everyone to hate.
So a foreign secretary writes an article in the broadsheet newspaper, interpreted as a thinly veiled leadership bid. Attacks and humiliation then follow. He backs down and the embattled, weakened Prime Minister goes on to fight another day. But enough about David Miliband's Guardian article in 2007. Let's talk about Theresa May's speech. Now, Theresa May's speech, Steve, it was apparently it was briefed as an opportunity to go over the heads of EU negotiators and go straight to the leaders of European countries. Mm-hmm. How many leaders of European countries were actually there in Florence?
Precisely zero. The audience was made up primarily of the British press.
The thing I don't understand is, I understand governments who say they are not going to negotiate with terrorists, but the May government position appears to be that we don't negotiate with negotiators.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. I think the problem is they are hitting roadblocks in the fact that Michel Barnier has basically orders from multiple places. He's got orders from the EU Commission, orders from EU heads of state, and orders from the European Parliament to a certain degree as well, although they do have a separate negotiator in the form of Guy Verhofstadt, the former Prime Minister of Belgium. He's got his marching orders, he's sticking with them, and he's basically saying we can't move on to talk about trade until we've dealt with the rights of EU citizens, the divorce bill, and, of course, thorny issue of the border between Northern and the Republic of Ireland.
Mm. All of which Theresa May mentioned in her speech, and we'll talk about them in a second. I do think, though, it is a mistake to try and sideline Barnier, partly for the practical reasons that he's the guy you're negotiating with. But also, Barnier wants to be EU Commission President when Jean-Claude Juncker steps down. And for that to happen, the Brexit talks need to be made a success of, to paraphrase our embattled Prime Minister. They can't fail. If they're seen to fail, then that's a black mark against him when the next commission elections are up. So actually, that's a good card we have in our hand. We should be relying on his goodwill, and that's just something we're not even trying to get.
No, and again, I think the problem here is that the government seems to be focused on the notion that the European Union is made up of the member states. And, you know, that is true. Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron, those leaders do have influence on the negotiations. The European Union is its own distinct body. The issue that the government is having is that they can't quite accept that they're having to deal with the EU and not those nation states. Because actually, if it was the nation states, it would probably be easier.
It would be familiar from anyone who watched the negotiations with Greece about their debt crisis going on. Varoufakis has written about this in his memoirs and a few other self-publicising speeches and interviews, that the EU is always looking for goodwill, and with Greece it's goodwill on structural adjustment programmes to try and adjust its government spending. With Britain, as you say, it's goodwill on divorce bill, EU citizens' rights. And talks won't move on until the EU is satisfied. And the EU knows that one of its main leverages is time. The EU has time to wait. Britain has no time to waste.
Yeah, it's something that the government has kind of fallen victim to. And this is why, actually, in many ways, the speech that Theresa May gave is actually quite significant, is that for the first time ever, they've accepted that Brexit might be a little bit complicated and actually come out and said, we actually need this transitional period. It's not as long as, you know, some people were saying it could be. I believe some people were briefing 5 years. We're down to two.
Now, of course, it's not a transitional period, though. It's an implementation period.
Of course, yes.
The only problem being we don't have anything to actually implement
yet.
But on that, the speech then, what's the content of the speech? What did she actually say?
The big kind of theme throughout most of the speech was about rebirth and a renaissance for Europe. Rebirth of Britain's relationship with Europe, rebirth of, in many ways, the European Union itself. Just a week or so ago, Juncker came out and started talking about further integration, the creation of an EU defence force.
EU cyborgs being produced in Luxembourg.
Well, I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords. But yeah, Juncker basically gave a speech saying, we want to be more integrated. This is the direction of travel that Europe's probably going to go in.
Classic federalist nonsense.
Yeah, again, once Britain's out of the picture, that was always going to be the way that Europe was going to move. So yeah, so in that sense, the speech kind of, to a degree, addressed the kind of the rebirth of the notion of what Europe is going to be as well. That theme of rebirth, kind of that the calling up of the Renaissance is quite interesting again, because May explicitly called out the Renaissance as almost being the peak of Europeanism. It's when Europe was at its most creative, innovative, when it was communal, working together, make great strides for mankind and for Europe as a whole.
I would have chosen the Eurovision Song Contest myself.
So would I, but aside from the fact that displays a shocking lack of historical literacy, given that on Wikipedia there's an entire page entitled Italian Wars, just focused on the Renaissance period before you even get to all the other nations.
I can't wait for the rebirth of all the Protestant Catholic wars we're going to have over the next 20 years.
It's going to be amazing. Well, you're saying that. Look at Northern Ireland.
It's too soon.
But that kind of that focus on Renaissance and that creativity and innovation and calling for the fact that we need this creativity as part of the Brexit negotiations. As I say, it's the first time really that the government seems to have displayed that this is going to be actually quite difficult, especially as what essentially has come out of this is that we're not going to be going for the European economic area, so we're not going for the Norway option, and we're not going to be going for the Canadian option area either, so we're not going to have a kind of just a free trade deal, quote unquote. We're going to go for something between the two, which, to be honest, makes a lot of sense.
That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. We'll have an episode out in the week with Fred Grinrod, and we're going to be talking about Brexit bias at the BBC. We have a Friday Fizz on the website notenoughchampagne.com, in which I talk about how the House of Lords has amended the EU withdrawal bill and the implications of that for the Tories, for Labour, for Brexit. And then Steve and I will be recording It's Inked In on the calendar next Saturday, and we'll be recording a few more episodes. And if you've got any suggestions for topics you'd like us to talk about, then you can tweet me at paperbackwriter, and you can tweet Steve at acousticradical. Happy plotting, everyone.